White, the case is submitted. We'll hear argument next to number 875367, Ralph Mills versus Maryland. We'll wait just a minute till the court quiets. Very well, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case presents a rather intriguing problem of cryptography. The cryptogram in question is contained in the Maryland Capital sentencing proceeding used in this case. It's set forth on page 14 of the petitioner's brief, and I quote, "Based upon the evidence, we unanimously find that each of the following mitigating circumstances, which is marked yes, has been proven to exist by a preponderance of the evidence, and each mitigating circumstance marked no has not been proven by preponderance of the evidence." The Court of Appeals' interpretation is that a reasonable juror reading that language will conclude that even though there's only the possibility in the form of yes and no, that there are actually three possibilities, that you have all agree for yes, all agree for no, or you have a split decision. Then this reasonable juror, without being instructed to do so, will conclude that if I disagree, I'll leave it blank. Then I'll retain the memory of my mitigating circumstance, and when it comes to weighing, aggravating, and mitigating, I, as an individual juror, will weigh this, even though my other jurors may not. None of this with instructions telling him to do that. An additional problem, however, is precisely the same language, with the substitution of beyond a reasonable doubt for preponderance of the evidence, is used to preface the aggravating circumstances. The Court of Appeals has held in Maryland the aggravating circumstances is simply either they're unanimous or it doesn't exist. So once again, our reasonable juror, when he comes upon this language in the aggravating circumstance, he looks at this language and says, well, the only possibility is either we all agree or it doesn't exist. A few moments later, encountering precisely the same language, our reasonable juror, who is now somewhat schizophrenic, concludes this language must mean something different now. It means, indeed, that there's a third possibility, this leaving it blank. I submit is the test, unless it's becoming a schizophrenic rather than reasonable juror, it's difficult to accept the Court of Appeals interpretation. Moreover, there are several external factors cutting against this interpretation. First of all,
before you go, I guess I have two different versions of the jury form here.
I apologize, Justice Scalia. There are two different versions.
Which is the true version?
The one that was used in this case is quoted in the brief and contained in the joint appendix. The one printed in the appendix to the brief is the one which was a modification with style only. There's also a third one, which is also included in the appendix, which is the one propounded subsequent to this case. So let me go back. There are actually three forms in Maryland, the one used in this case and the one that the language I quoted comes from. A second one where that language was changed slightly but is pointed out by Judge McAuliffe in his dissent just for stylistic purposes. That is in the joint appendix.
Page 99?
I believe that's correct. That's the modification that was not used in this case, but
where is the one that was used in this case?
In this case is in the joint appendix at, I believe...
14?
99 in joint appendix.
99.
And also 14 of the brief.
And 14 of the brief is the quote.
I got you.
So it is somewhat confusing. There are three, and as I say, Justice Scalia, there is a third one, and perhaps in some ways that's most significant. That's the one about a month after this case, there was an emergency change instituted. That one is also in the appendix to the petitioner's brief.
Appendix to the petitioner's brief.
Appendix 1A. 21A. So we have three. The last one was not used but was changed as a result of this case. Indeed, about a month after this case.
And the second one was not used in this case.
The second was not used in the case. We only put it there, and perhaps we shouldn't have, for information of the court that existed.
Well, it's been fun trying to, you know.
I apologize.
Will the real form please stand?
Judge Scalia, when I was looking over this case yesterday, I came to the conclusion that whatever reason we thought for putting that second form in there was probably not good and is somewhat confusing, and I apologize for that. Yes, Justice White, and I seem to have gotten lost in the cryptogram in this instance. But I think the key forms are this first form, and the second one's not really important anyway, it's just a stylistic change, and the new form. And I think, as the Court will note, the new form is at best a distant cousin to the first form. It specifically sets out the possibility. You either all agree, you don't agree, you're divided. And you mark. You have three alternatives for each mitigating. You mark according to these three possibilities. At the end of that form, it provides for each juror to individually assess what he thought or she thought the mitigating factors were. So if you had a situation where six jurors thought there were five mitigating factors, six didn't, those six jurors would weigh those mitigating factors against the aggravating. In short, I think it's very difficult to accept the Court of Appeals' assurance that every juror would have understood the first form when the Court of Appeals thought it was necessary on an emergency basis to drastically change that form. I also think it's worth pointing out, as the dissenter did in the Court of Appeals, that prior to this case, there's no evidence that any juror ever indicated in any way that there was a divided jury on any mitigating circumstance. Subsequent to this case, when there was an opportunity in the forms and instructions to show division, two of the three capital cases that were decided, jurors indeed demonstrated that they were split on some mitigating factors. I think the dissent persuasively points out that it defies reason to suppose this is all a matter of coincidence. I also think it's important to look at the interplay between the Court of Appeals' opinion and the brief of the state in this court. Court of Appeals has held that this reasonable juror is going to sit around and think of a rather intricate procedure to follow, even without instructions. The state, for its part, disagrees with the Court of Appeals. Indeed, the state says the Court of Appeals is wrong in how they interpret the statute. The state says that what the statute actually meant was that if you disagree, any disagreement on any mitigating factor, hung jury, mistrial. The Court of Appeals specifically rejected that interpretation in its opinion. The point of this, I think, on the one hand, we have the Court of Appeals offering an interpretation which then says every reasonable juror would have understood. Yet the state, even to this day, doesn't understand that interpretation. On the other hand, the state offers its interpretation that the Court of Appeals says it's wrong and didn't understand. I submit if the state and the Court of Appeals can't agree, it's far too much and far too optimistic to assume somehow that this hypothetical reasonable juror would have understood all of this or indeed any of it.
Would you go through it for me once more? You know, this is a kind of a hard case.
I understand, Justice Stevens.
The difference between the state and the Court of Appeals is that the Court of Appeals said that if there was disagreement on one mitigating factor, the consequence would be mistrial?
No. The Court of Appeals says that juror would conclude that we leave this blank, and then if I found the mitigating factor, say I was the only juror that did, if I found that mitigating factor, when we weighed aggravating and mitigating, in my mind, I would weigh them. And at that point, I might decide that even if I found this mitigating, aggravating still outweigh mitigating, you could have death, or it could be the other way.
I thought the State Court of Appeals said that the form would be left blank on such a
matter. That was their conclusion. No, their conclusion was that particular part of the form would be left blank. And that juror would know to leave it blank, and he would remember that he's entitled in the final analysis to use that mitigating circumstance. Now, the state's position is not that. The state's position
What do you mean he would remember? How could he fail to remember?
Well, I think
because it walks you through it, and in the determination of sentence, it says, one, if all of the answers in Section 1 are marked no, do this. If Section 2 was completed and all of the answers were marked no, then enter death. It doesn't take a whole lot of memory. It just takes reading the form. If all of them were not at mark no,
that's true.
If one of them was left blank, that means that all of them are not.
But of course,
no. It doesn't take a whole lot of ingenuity to figure.
True,
out.
But it presupposes, of course, that you understood in the beginning that you could leave it blank and that you were entitled on an individual basis.
You mean your second point is your first point?
They're related, Justice Scalia, and I.
One and the same. It's.
And I don't think so, because I think if you look at the new form, the Court of Appeals thought it was necessary to add specific language at the end, saying that each individual juror would do this. So apparently, the Court of Appeals, notwithstanding their opinion in Mills, wasn't so sure that jurors would understand unless they were told.
Well, you can always make something that's tolerably good better. I mean, I don't think that we should decide this case on the basis that this form could have been improved.
I agree. I agree with that. But I think just looking at the forms, we don't really have much in terms of making good better we have here. If you weren't familiar with the statute, I'd be willing to bet that I could show these two to any lawyer and you would never guess they came from the same state. These forms are decidedly different. And I think it's difficult on the one hand to say that it's important and it's certainly good to explain all these things. And the same thing could have presumably been accomplished if you said we use this form but we give all these instructions. But the point is these are decisive differences between these two forms.
I think you ought to talk about this case as though there hadn't been a new form published. And just you're faced then with the Court of Appeals opinion that the form that was used in this case was perfectly adequate.
Yeah, they said that, Justice White.
Yes, well, that's your problem.
I don't think so, because as I point out, one of the problems, and I see, besides the instructions not directing the jury to do any of these mental gymnastics, the other problem is this language using the same language in the aggravating and the mitigating. Yet, at the same time, saying a juror, without being told to do so, is going to have to treat it in a different way, although it's the same language in the aggravating and
Mr.
mitigating.
Mr. Burns, I take it the defendant in this case made no objection to the use of this particular form and made no objections to the instructions given at the time.
That is true, Justice O'Connor.
So for you to prevail, we would have to find that the error amounted to plain error if it
I don't think so, Justice O'Connor, because, of course, the Court of Appeals did not decide it on this basis. And I think what it really comes down to, if the Court of Appeals is right, of course, there's no problem. Everyone understood, and these were all the instructions you were entitled to. If we're right, what we're saying is no rational person could have possibly understood what the Court of Appeals has to date, in this case, said, and therefore no one would have objected because no one would have thought this was really what it meant. So I think in this case, in a normal case, that would be true, but I think the two problems here, procedurally, Court of Appeals didn't decide it on that, and in the way the Court of Appeals decided it, and our position being that the Court of Appeals obviously has a right to interpret the statute, but they don't have a right to interpret it in a dramatically new way and then apply it to this petitioner.
Well, at least we know that on the form that this jury returned, they at least, the jurors indicated they had unanimously agreed that there were no mitigating factors.
They did, Justice O'Connor, but of course there's no evidence to show, and they were certainly never told. If you look at the instructions, it was clear, unanimous, yes or no. They weren't told anything about this possibility that perhaps if you're not unanimous, then you still may retain your individual judgment
and
leave it plain.
The fact is, though, we have a situation where they've indicated unanimously that they don't find any of the mitigating circumstances or any at all.
Well, we have a form. Our position is we have a situation where they've indicated that it's not unanimous that they find one. Now, the Court of Appeals says, and that, I think, is the Court of Appeals' interpretation, is that there's more than that. There's also a finding that they necessarily unanimously don't find the non-existence. That is the opposite. The problem, of course, is that there's nothing, no instruction even coming close to talking about that case. Nothing on the form talking about that case. And so what it really comes down
Weren't
to is a matter of faith.
Weren't they told several times in the instructions they had to be unanimous on all their findings as to mitigation?
They were told, but I think that may cut the other way because they think they would also have to be told the other thing. If the Court of Appeals' interpretation to be correct, that you also have to be unanimous on the lack thereof. Because if you're told you have to be unanimous, it seems to me the jury can say, then we don't find it. No. 11 of us thought it was. One person didn't think it was. Therefore, we aren't unanimous. We mark no. That's the problem, I think, in this case, is obviously none of us can tell what went on in the jury room. But I think
there's absolutely no indication to support your hypothesis. I mean, we have the return forms by the jury and the instructions, and they tally perfectly. Your hypothesis is that some jurors might have reasoned a different way, but there's simply no indication that they did.
Well, the problem, Chief Justice Rehnquist, is, of course, our position is under these forms, there's no way they would have any way to communicate that to anyone. And if you set up the form in such a way and set up the instructions in such a way that you don't offer the possibility of this third possibility, then you're always never going to get the third possibility. I don't think that means it doesn't exist. It just means that you've presented to the jury in such a way that unless you have a juror who's very, very creative, is even if he thinks all these things, or even if 11 thinks all them, there's simply nothing in the form to suggest that they can show that to the court.
It's just as likely that there was unanimity, actual unanimity.
Well, there could have been, I obviously
could have been.
But I think the problem is
not unusual.
For the Court of Appeals, Well, the court, for the Court of Appeals to be correct, I think it has to be more than a toss of the coin. There has to be some certainty. And the only certainty it seems to me that you can get is if you have very specific instructions or a form that makes it clear that the jury knows what it is you're doing. Indeed, I think it's interesting that even one judge of the Court of Appeals says that he would have never imagined this system and could never believe that anyone had thought of it. No one had ever talked about it in the past, and yet we're asking the court, this court, to believe that jurors on their own were fully aware of all of these subtleties that I think are fairly difficult even at this point to understand. As to the victim impact issue, I would only comment on the harmless error argument.
Counsel, one question before you get to that. If the jury had simply been instructed orally with no form, would your argument be the same?
I think, depending on the instruction.
Instructions are the same.
Then I think it would be the same, because I think these instructions fairly cover this form. So I think either way, you have the instructions in the form, I agree, are absolutely absolutely consistent in this case. I think that may be the problem. And the reason I ask that, Justice Kennedy, because there you might have a case where, by instructions, obviously, you could give all these alternatives, and then even with a form that we would say was inadequate, it might be okay. But in this case, you had instructions. Obviously, the judge thought the form worked that way, not unreasonably. As to the harmless error...
Before you get to the other question, too, in your brief, you list seven potentially mitigating circumstances on page 4. And I gather the defense lawyer did argue those to the jury.
He did, and there's one other one we pointed out, footnote 4, they didn't argue. He argued them, yes. There was evidence presented for these that they could have found.
Well, do you interpret the jury's finding that there were no mitigating circumstances to mean that they didn't think these were factually correct, or that if indeed the man had a low IQ, we don't consider that mitigating?
An interesting question, Justice Stevens. I'm not sure because, again, there's no way of knowing what a juror thought about this. It seems to me...
Did the judge give them any help on that?
The judge gave the general, as we set out, routine instructions. He did not specifically say that. He really put it into the jury and said that you consider it, and they do consider it. Now, I think it's possible, obviously, a juror could, I suppose, in a case, consider them factually. But most of these things, I mean, some of them are argumentative.
Well, was there evidence in the record that he terminated his education at the sixth grade?
Yes, Justice Stevens, evidence like that.
Was that a disputed fact?
Most of the factual things were not. They were not disputed. So it would seem if the jury all concluded that it was not, it would seem that their finding is not mitigating.
So what they're saying, in effect, is these facts are not sufficiently significant even to be justified as being called mitigating, so we don't have to even weigh them.
I think
it's
so,
quite
Justice
different
Stevens.
From
I think
saying
that's a fair interpretation.
We find these
the
facts, but
facts.
We think the aggravating circumstances are much more serious.
I think so, Justice Stevens. I think it's a fair interpretation, at least the ones that present more or less historical facts, because they're not things that are seriously or that are all disputed, I should say.
I see.
If you please, counsel, one more question on this point. I'm not sure I understood your answer to Justice O'Connor's question when she asked you she pointed out to you that there had been no objection below.
There was, as I agree, there certainly has not been. Well, I think there are two points. One is the procedural point. The Court of Appeals never addressed this and never, perhaps they could have, but they didn't say that there was any procedural bar to the consideration. But the second, I think, perhaps more important point is if the Court of Appeals is correct, and this is all clear to everyone, there'd be no reason you'd be entitled to no more instruction. If we're correct, and you could possibly have foreseen what the Court of Appeals says this means, then no reasonable person would have foreseen it and asked an instruction. So I think in this particular case, that's the reason, the double reason. I think perhaps that's why the Court of Appeals didn't address the problem of whether or not there were objections. On the harmless error point and the victim impact.
You're going to leave to your briefs whatever question there may be as to whether the introduction of this evidence was a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
Yes, of course, Chief Justice, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. But our position in that has been set out in the brief, and of course, obviously, we're relying on Booth. And our point was, I think, too, one, that the Court of Appeals simply ignored one prong of the Booth test. And the state's response is, in part, that it's harmless because there were no mitigating factors brought back. The state arguing you can't have any bad influence.
Well, I understood the state to argue it was not a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
Yes, Chief Justice, and obviously we, for the same reasons in Booth, think it is. And if you have any other further questions, I'll be happy to answer them, but I have not obviously repeated them because we rely absolutely on Booth. The harmless error is separate, though, and that's why I wanted to say something about that, is the argument being that you don't have a weighing and balancing because there are no mitigating, therefore it's harmless. The problem, of course, is if you have improper evidence come in, then that also affects in the weighing and balance perhaps of whether you decide a historical fact really is worth bringing back a mitigating. So the prejudice can arise before you get to the weighing and balance in between aggravating and mitigating. So indeed, I suggest it cannot be harmless. Thank you.
I do have one further question. You also are assuming on the first point about the form, you're assuming without arguing that if the form did require if it was misleading, and if the jury indeed didn't realize that they had to be unanimous as to no mitigating circumstance, then it would be unconstitutional.
Yes, Justice Scalia. The reason I haven't argued is, of course, the Court of Appeals did not decide that it was unconstitutional, but decided that clearly that wasn't going to be the law in Maryland. I think, as we pointed out in our brief, that you would have a very serious constitutional problem, because what it would amount to, if it were interpreted as we originally thought it was to be interpreted, you could have, in essence, one juror deciding you're going to get capital punishment, even though 11 might disagree.
It would still allow all mitigating circumstances to be taken into account. It would be a state saying if the jury unanimously finds one aggravating circumstance, they are entitled to consider all mitigating circumstances. But if they find a mitigation, once they've unanimously found one of these aggravating circumstances, they have to find it unanimously. And that's unconstitutional. It doesn't narrow the jury's discretion. It prevents frivolous and irrational and inconsistent decisions quite well.
It may be that you – no, I'm not so sure about that, Justice Scalia, because it may be you could draft a statute getting around the problem of unanimity, but I think here you'd have a fully open statute. And what I mean by that is you'd have the situation literally where – one juror says, I think this person deserves death. I don't think there are any mitigating factors. 11 jurors think there are 13 mitigating factors, and it's simply overwhelming. And yet, the one juror, that is a one juror rule, if you're unlucky to get one juror who thinks you should get death, then you're going to get death. And I find it very difficult to understand how that can be not arbitrary, because what you're doing in that case is saying is the biggest single test might be not mitigating and aggravating, but whether you get one juror who doesn't think you deserve
it. Well, it has to be more than that. You have to have one juror who thinks there should be death and 12 jurors who find the particular aggravating circumstance.
You do have to find the aggravating. As a practical matter, however, if you look at these aggravating factors, they're usually things that are going to be, in effect, having litigated a trial. The most common one is felony murder. Now, if you found someone guilty of felony murder, you're logically, for example, going to have an aggravating. So I agree, you do have to have the aggravating. Yeah. But in very few of these cases...
But you're saying if one juror finds no mitigating circumstance or nothing that he would regard as mitigating, and 12 agree with him that this was a murder committed in prison or whatever the aggravating factor is, and all 11 think there are mitigating circumstances, then the statute mandates death, doesn't it?
It would, if interpreted the way Justice Scalia, I think, was asking the question.
Well, even under this form, it would.
Under this form,
as we interpret it.
In that sense, we're in agreement. I'm sorry, Justice Scalia. I was getting to the constitutionality question. That's true. We do interpret it in that way. The problem with the constitutionality is that you would have the situation. If we're right, that's the exact problem that you have. Is you have the possibility of not 12 jurors agreeing, but one juror deciding it's death. And our position, of course, is it's difficult to imagine a more arbitrary system than luck of the draw, do I get one juror?
Well, I don't know. Suppose it only takes one to find a mitigating circumstance, and that's going to be enough. Or a majority, you can say, well, you know, it's the difference. Whether you die or not depends on whether it's 6 or 7-5 one way or 7-5 the other way. How arbitrary life is. I mean, you can say that no matter what kind of a system you adopt. It's always going to turn on one vote, isn't it?
You can certainly say that, Justice Scalia, but we draw lines every day, and I suggest that the one where one's enough to execute is probably a line no one really wants to draw. I agree with you that at some point, for example, this court in an entirely different situation, talking about majority verdicts in non-capital cases, has said, yes, everything's arbitrary, and we may tolerate certain ones up to a point. We draw a line, but we do have to draw a line. And under this interpretation of this statute, the line is 1 and 12, and I suggest.
Zero versus one against, and you think it should be seven versus five. I don't see that that rises to that one seems terribly arbitrary and the other one doesn't. Maybe one is harsher than the other. I can understand that, but I don't see how one is capricious.
I think in the context of the jury system that we're looking for a jury of 12 people to decide this to say, in effect, we'll tolerate one thing, it is capricious. Because if we look at the jury, even if we had a 7-5, at least we're giving some play to the notion that it's the group, it's the jury deciding it. If we're looking at one, I don't want to use the term anti-democratic, but it is sort of an odd notion in a more or less democratic society of this extreme decision being made on the basis of one opposed to 11. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Mr. Monk, we'll hear from you now.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the last instruction, the very last instruction the jury in this case heard before it retired to deliberate, and this is on page 95 of the Joint Appendix, is as follows. The Court said, as he had passed out the forms to the jury, let me remind you that as you consider each of the circumstances, you must indicate yes or no. However, your unanimous decision falls. You must indicate yes or no as to each of those circumstances. It seems to me that that instruction, together with the form that was used in this case, plus the instructions that were the court before the closing arguments of counsel went through the form and six or seven times reminded the jury that their determination on each question must be unanimous.
Where is that? Where in the materials here? I'd like to look at what did he tell them just before they went?
At page 95, Justice Scalia.
Page 95 of what?
Of the Joint Appendix. The closing arguments are concluded. The court has already reviewed with the jury before closing arguments the form itself, which is discussed in our brief, and now he is sending the jury out to deliberate. And he stops him and he says, let me remind you, as you consider each of the circumstances, you must indicate yes or no, however your unanimous decision falls.
What point are you making?
My point, Justice White, is that these instructions, read by a reasonable juror, would have led them to conclude that they must unanimously decide yes or no on each one of the mitigating circumstances.
Exactly.
And if that is so, then we don't have a Lockett-Eddings problem in this case, because the jury deliberated, considered the evidence presented in mitigation, and rejected it.
So, as I read your brief, and I understand, I seem to have the same notion now. You don't think you need to go through the routine that the Court of Appeals did to sustain this?
I don't think that, with all due respect to Mr. Burns, that his interpretation of what the Court of Appeals said is correct. I think the Court of Appeals reached precisely that point. Their view was that the statute requires unanimity as to yes or no on respect to mitigating circumstances, that they considered that the jury in this case considered the evidence.
And that if 11 jurors thought there was a mitigating circumstance and one thought not, the jury had to proceed on the basis that there were no mitigating circumstances.
No, that's not correct. If 11 jurors thought there was a mitigating circumstance and one thought there was not, the jury would have to continue to deliberate until they reached a conclusion. And if they couldn't reach a conclusion, then there would be a hung jury. If you look at the Joint Appendix where the Court of Appeals opinion is at 126 to 127, the Court of Appeals makes that exact argument.
So you say that under that instruction, the way it would work out, there couldn't have been a holdout juror. There couldn't have been a holdout juror
There could have been a holdout juror, and the jury would have hung.
But then there would have been another proceeding.
No, under the Maryland statute, imprisonment would have been imposed. The instructions in this case, and I think this is a jury instruction case under California versus Brown, I think the court is obligated to look at all the instructions, including the language of the form and the instructions that the court gave as it explained the form in this final instruction that I pointed out, and determine what a reasonable juror under the circumstance would have, how he or she would have viewed this instruction. And I think it's very clear that they would have concluded that there was a requirement of unanimity, and they had to make an ultimate determination.
So there would have been a hung jury. I mean, that's exactly and right. a life imprisonment.
What do you do with the petitioner's argument when he points out that the form had been used 25 or 30 times and the no's were filled out in every case all the same, and the minute they changed the form, blanks began to occur?
Well, Justice Kennedy, I mean, the instructions of this court were answer every question. So I would expect in every form in the other cases when this was used that they would have answered every question. When they changed the form, when the new form came into place, and the jury was given the opportunity to say, well, we've taken an initial straw vote, and some of us think there's mitigating evidence here, but we all can't agree, they didn't have to force themselves to deliberate and debate the issue further. They were just given the opportunity on the new form to indicate that and go on to weighing. And so I don't think they were compelled, as a jury, through the deliberative process to reach a conclusion.
If somebody felt like leaving something blank under the old form, there would just have been a hung jury.
Well, if they could not reach a conclusion and therefore they decided to leave it blank under the old form, they would have had a hung
jury. And it would have been life imprisonment.
That's correct. And indeed, there is at least one case in the
law. So the new form may make it more likely that death will be imposed.
Well, that's exactly the problem that the Court of Appeals thinks that they were addressing, and as set forth in their opinion, explains why the new form comes into being. They posit what they describe as the anomalous circumstance where the jury might hang on mitigating circumstances, but if they had gotten to weighing, would have concluded the death penalty should be imposed.
Anyway,
so under the Maryland scheme, life imprisonment would have been imposed. In order to avoid that circumstance, they announced, therefore, the new form, which allows the jury to say, well, we can't all agree on mitigating circumstances, but we'll go to weighing anyhow and reach an ultimate conclusion.
Yeah, I ask you just to be sure, it's kind of hard to keep this complicated case in mind. Did Maryland law at the time of this trial require that any finding of a mitigating circumstance be unanimous?
The Maryland Court of Appeals so stated.
In this opinion. Had it previously done that? Was there anything in the text of the statute?
The statute itself talks about unanimity and the final version. And the Maryland Court of Appeals had adopted the form, although there's one minor change between the form that was used in this case and the rule,
the statute so required, how could they authorize the new form?
Well, what they did was, under the old arrangement, before the new form came into place, the Court of Appeals, relying upon the statute and relying upon their rulemaking authority, adopted a form which mandated unanimity for a no answer on the form. The statute itself talks in terms of unanimity for yes. It does not talk in terms of unanimity for no. And it also has a unanimity for the ultimate determination.
So there was no statutory requirement that a finding of no mitigating circumstances be unanimous.
But Maryland law was, by virtue of the rule adopted by the Court of Appeals, which is a part of Maryland law, that unanimity was required.
You mean the rule adopted in this case?
No, a rule that was pre-existing this case, because the form itself is adopted by rule in Maryland, and it was in place for all the cases that were decided before.
Was there a rule other than the rule approving of this form? Or was that
no, that is the
so that that, so to the extent the form was ambiguous, or at least as a dissenting justice in the Court of Appeals thought, that ambiguity would also have existed in the rule.
That's correct.
And okay.
Unless it was clarified by the judge.
And so that when they adopted a new form, they basically changed the law, under your view.
When they adopted a new form, they allowed the jury to get hung up on.
Well, I understand, but they did change the law.
That's correct. They did.
Mr. Attorney General, we do recognize, don't we, that nobody at these two tables here, nobody here, two people, agree what those forms mean, yet 12 jurymen can easily understand it. We recognize that, don't we?
Well, Justice Marshall, I can't agree with you. I think that if you read the instructions in this case, as I think you're compelled to do, in their totality, under California versus Brown, I...
Room for disagreement.
Well, I don't believe so, Justice Marshall. I think that those instructions, read fairly and reasonably, would lead a reasonable juror in these circumstances to conclude they had to reach unanimous agreement. Do you think
that your rationale for affirmance is the same as the Court of Appeals used?
I believe it is. I believe it is.
Can I ask you, General Monk, about another portion of the form? I hope I'm using the right one. It's on 16A and 17A. Now, never, we're past Section 2, where they have to mark yes or no, and we've established that they only mark no if they unanimously find no mitigating circumstance.
That's right? Correct.
And they leave it blank if only 11 of them find a mitigating circumstance, right? They then move on to Section 3 of the form, which begins at the bottom of 16A and goes over to the top of 17A. We unanimously find that it has been proven by a preponderance of the evidence that the mitigating circumstances marked yes outweigh the aggravating marked yes. Right?
That's what.
So if they've left some of those forms blank by reason of the fact there are only 11 of them that think that they're mitigating, they are really only still in the balancing. They are only going to balance those mitigating circumstances that have been unanimously found. So they would check, and let's assume that on the basis of those, there are few of them, or there are none of them, they check they don't outweigh the aggravating circumstances. Then that moves them on to the last part of the form, determination of sentence. Okay? And they'd go down to number 4 if Section 3 was completed and was marked no, enter death. They would come back with a death sentence, wouldn't they? And the only way you would know that you had a hung jury is if the judge didn't just look at the bottom of the form, but went back and looked in Section 2 and saw, by God, they came in with a death sentence, but I know that that's wrong because, in fact, some of the portions of Section 2 are neither checked yes or no. Isn't that the only way you'd get a hung jury? The jury would not know itself to be hung. Well, it would go right through to the end of the form, come in with a death penalty, and the judge would find out they're hung because there were no answers to some of Section 2.
Justice Scalia, I don't mean to quarrel with your hypothetical, but I don't think that's the way it operates.
Okay. Tell me why not.
Well, for the first reason is, as the judge in this case instructed, he instructed the jury, you must indicate yes or no as to each of those circumstances. They weren't given the option of a non-answer. And that's why they answered every one of these questions. That's why the dissent points out in every one of the capital cases that you look
you
at.
You must be unanimous? How can a judge instruct them to be unanimous?
Well, just as a judge instructs them to be unanimous at the guilt or innocence phase, reach a determination. Do you agree that the defendant is guilty or not? And if the poll, the straw poll with guilt or innocence is 7-5, that the answer is he's not guilty. The answer is that you continue to deliberate.
They'd come back out and say we can't finish Section 2 because we cannot get unanimity on either yes or no. That's what you're saying.
That is exactly right. Indeed, there is one circumstance in the lodging. It would be life imprisonment under the Maryland procedure because they could not reach a unanimous verdict. And that's exactly why the Court of Appeals posits in their hypothetical that if they hang on mitigation, but had they gotten to weighing, they would have decided the death penalty, that then there's a need for a change in the form. I would like to just make a few more points on this issue before I turn to...
Let me just clarify one other thing.
Yes,
I am correct, am I not, that the judge did not specifically tell them what to do if the situation should arise that they were not unanimous on a mitigating circumstance.
He did not...
Other than the general statement that it must be unanimity.
He did not... If your question is, did he instruct them what would happen if they were hung, he did not so instruct them.
Well, I'm just hung on whether or not there was a particular, 6 or 7 mitigating circumstances. If there was not unanimity on one of the mitigating circumstances, did he tell them what to do there? He didn't tell them to leave it blank, is what I'm really
asking. No, that is correct.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, he did just the opposite. He said, consider each of the circumstances, you must indicate yes or no, however your unanimous decision falls. Those were his exact words.
Yeah.
You must indicate yes or no as to each of those circumstances. That's the last instruction the jury got from the court before they retired to deliberate. That instruction is very clear. It tells them.
If they answered this way.
That's exactly right. The jury reached a unanimous verdict, and there's no objective evidence here that would suggest there was any disagreement. Chief Justice Rehnquist asked the question to Burns, is there anything to suggest that this is anything more than a hypothetical? The answer is clearly no.
Of course, Mr. Burns' response was that the forum didn't give them any opportunity to express it if there were non-unanimity.
Well, Justice Rehnquist, it seems to me that they would have, there are two possibilities. If they could not agree, they would have come back to the court and said, we can't agree. We know at least in one circumstance, one of the lodgings that was submitted to the court by the petitioner, that a jury, in fact, did hang. And it appears that they hung up on mitigating circumstances, and they deliberated for 12 hours, and a life imprisonment was imposed.
Well, Mr. Monk, does any jury form in an ordinary case? Let's not talk about a capital case for a minute. You're asking the jury to decide whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. Now, does the verdict form in your state ever have another blank for them to indicate if they're hung, or are they just given check guilty or not guilty and you must be unanimous?
They are not instructed in Maryland that what the possibility of hanging might be. They're asked to make a determination.
That what most states do? There's never another form for if you're hung, is there?
That's correct.
Jury
and indeed, you don't want to encourage a jury to not be able to reach a conclusion, to hang. And that's the whole purpose of not including that notion or instructing the jury.
Yes, but what is the reason for requiring unanimity when you're not agreed that there isn't a mitigating circumstance? It's a little different than the normal situation.
Well, Justice Stevens,
form indicator recognizes.
The mitigating circumstances under the state statute are, there are seven statutorily defined mitigating circumstances, and then another category.
A catch-all
for anything else. And the first seven are really factual determinations that the court, the rule is requiring the jury to make. Tell us whether you find that there's credible evidence to support whatever the mitigating circumstances. And that is a question capable of a yes or no answer. We've listened to the evidence, we've weighed it, and we don't find it credible. We mark no. We listen to the evidence and we do find it credible. Yes, that mitigating circumstance exists. We go to the next one. That's the process.
Yes, but some of the mitigating circumstances on which he relied really were not in dispute factually. He was a man of limited education, a man of low IQ. He was 19 or 20 years old. I can't remember what it was. The question they really answered there was whether they thought what was described as a mitigating circumstance really was entitled to that label. I think, because there really was. Well, correct me if I'm wrong about that.
Well, I think you are part wrong, Justice Stevens. Let me see if I can't explain. The trial judge, in his trial judge's report, which is required under the Maryland statute, said, I don't disagree with the conclusions reached by the jury, although there was evidence of a mitigating circumstance, youth. He was 20 years old. Now, the argument of counsel at the sentencing phase was, the prosecutor said, well, he's 20.
I understand on that one, but on the sixth grade education, the low IQ, I know they're not one of the enumerated.
They are not one of the enumerated ones.
You suggest that no juror, none of the 12 jurors, that you're satisfied that none of the 12 jurors, you certainly aren't saying they didn't think those facts were correct?
Well, what I'm saying is under number 8, the jury makes a two-part determination, it seems to me. One part is, do we find credible evidence that this fact exists or not? And the second part is, does that fact mitigate?
Correct.
Because 1 through 7 are defined to be mitigating. But number 8 is a two-part question.
And so what they really, because the facts were essentially undisputed, they're really saying none of us think that a low IQ or a sixth grade education has any mitigating value at all.
That's correct. That's
probably what they concluded.
I believe
rather
that
than that, they were not convinced unanimously that those factors should be considered mitigating. Which is what the dissenting judge apparently.
That's right. And their answer to number 8 was none.
Right.
I mean, they affirmatively went to the point. This jury seems to me.
You know, those instructions and those forms said you should answer no to a mitigating circumstance unless you're unanimous that it exists.
Well, Justice White, I don't.
In order to find a mitigating circumstance, you must be unanimous.
That's right. In order to find that there's no mitigating circumstance, you must be unanimous. And if you're in neither position, you must continue to deliberate. And if you can't,
yes, but then he didn't tell him. That he did not tell.
And
well, he did, I believe. The last instruction, I believe, precisely does that. It says, however your unanimous decision falls. Right. Answer yes or no.
Was crazy.
Well, certainly could have been a lot clearer. It's hard to believe that in a matter of this importance, those instructions could have been drafted that way.
Boy, Justice Scalia, let me
just to read them, they certainly don't leap out and mean that to me.
I think if you look at all the instructions together, I believe that under California versus Brown, a reasonable juror would have understood the instructions to be read as the Court of Appeals interpreted them in this case. But there's a couple other things that I can point to that might lead you to that same conclusion.
I shouldn't be interrupting you so much. May I ask you a historical question, because there was reference that Justice Kennedy made. Has there ever been a case in Maryland in which the jury filled out everything in the form except one mitigating circumstance, including a recommendation of death, and then the judge said, well, they obviously were hung on the mitigating circumstance, so it must be a life sentence?
No, there has been a circumstance where the jury answered the aggravating questions, found an aggravating circumstance, got to the mitigating circumstance, answered one of those yes, didn't fill out anything else, and was hung, deliberated for 12 hours. And
but the jury was hung on the ultimate determination, too.
Well, I submit we don't know. The form has.
The thing that's unlikely, it seems to me, in the way that things happen in real life, is that they would come to the unanimous conclusion that there should be a death sentence, but that they should be hung on an intermediate circumstance and a mitigating factor and leave that blank. And I gather that has never happened. Whereas if it did happen, you're telling me a judge would look at the form and impose a life sentence.
Well, if the jury was unable to reach a determination on each one of the questions, right, then they would be hung and a life sentence under the
form. Yes, but even though they filled out the rest of the form, they said they just left one mitigating blank, filled everything else out that would qualify for a capital for the death sentence. The judge would then, under Maryland law, have a duty to impose the life sentence and
that's right.
Just
that
because
is
of that one blank.
That is
in
the anomalous circumstance that the Court of Appeals was concerned about and therefore announced the new form to be used in future cases.
That has never happened, so okay.
At page 141 of the joint appendix, the majority opinion discusses in the first full paragraph the jury's duty, and as I understand it, if the jury is hung on mitigating, they go ahead and weigh aggravating anyway.
Well, the aggravating comes first on the form, Justice Kennedy.
But it says that if they're hung as to mitigating, they go on in any event to determine the aggravating circumstance.
I'm sorry, Justice Kennedy. That passage that you're referring to in 141, I think they're referring to the new procedure, not the form that was in place at the time that this case was decided. Remember that in the Court of Appeals in this case announced that they didn't want the form to be limited as it was in this case, which would create the circumstance if the jury couldn't reach a determination of mitigating, but had gone on to weigh and had reached the death penalty, under those circumstances they would have been a hung jury and life imprisonment would be imposed under the Maryland statute. They wanted to avoid that anomalous circumstance, so they announced this new form. Let me just point out a couple more points with respect to this issue, and why I think a reasonable juror would have read the instructions the way the Court of Appeals held it to be. The defendant in this case did not object to these instructions. There is nothing in the closing arguments from defense counsel or from the prosecutor which suggested that anybody understood the form in any way other than it was a unanimous decision was required by the jury on each one of the questions presented.
But the Court of Appeals didn't rely on that at all, did they?
The Court of Appeals did not rely on that.
Well, they didn't, did they?
They did not. That, If you agree with the Maryland Court of Appeals that a reasonable juror would have understood these instructions to require a unanimous decision whether the answer was yes or no to the mitigating circumstances, then there really is not a problem under Lockett or Eddings. The defendant was given the opportunity to present his evidence in mitigation for the jury to consider it, and the jury in this case did consider it and rejected it. And therefore, there was nothing to weigh, and the statute is not impermissibly mandatory. The Maryland statute was designed to impose a system of guided discretion so that the Court of Appeals could conduct a proportionality review and so that in each case, whether the defendant be sentenced by a judge or a jury, the same process would obtain. The court would know what aggravating factor the sentencer had relied upon for a determination, what mitigating factor the sentencer had found, and what the ultimate decision was. The word sentencer, I think, is key because the determination here, the sentencer, is the jury in the context when a jury is selected by the defendant. It's not individual members of the jury. It is the jury as a whole. And juries, under Maryland law, decide things unanimously. I'd like to turn, if I could now, briefly to our argument with respect to the victim impact evidence in Booth. This case was decided by the Court of Appeals 10 days after the decision in Booth. The issue was not briefed or argued before the court. The Court of Appeals construes the evidence that came in this case not to be victim impact evidence within the meaning of the Maryland statute. This evidence did come in as victim impact evidence. It was introduced, read to the jury as a victim impact statement. I think it is distinguishable, however, from the victim impact evidence that came in Booth in the sense that it is the total other end of the spectrum. The victim impact statement that came in Booth was inflammatory. It contained calls possibly for the death penalty. It commented on the evidence. It described in great detail the sufferings of the children and grandchildren of the victims.
You were defending that in Booth, weren't you?
Yes, I was, Justice Blackmun. And I think this case is an opportunity for the court to rethink its holding in Booth. I think the decision in Booth goes too far. I think it would be appropriate for the court to limit Booth to the context and uphold the Court of Appeals in this case by saying it is okay to consider the victim themselves, not the victim's children or grandchildren or a call for the death penalty. Clearly that's bad.
Well, that wouldn't be a limitation of Booth. The Booth holding was that the particular impact evidence there had to be excluded. Everything else is dicta.
The victim impact evidence in Booth included all of those things, Justice Rankin.
It's not often that a lawyer gets to argue the same case twice.
It is not, Justice Marshall. And I beg the court's indulgence. It seems to me
even rarer that he wins, loses the first time and wins the second.
Understanding that, Justice Scalia, let me just make one more point about Booth and how this court might distinguish the decision in that case from this case. This victim was the lowest part of humanity. He was a convicted felon in jail, and he was murdered by his cell buddy. The victim impact in this case came in only to give some humanity to him. So when the jury tried to determine what the loss to society was from this life, they at least understood who this victim was. Can it be that this court intends for victim impact to be so excluded that we would simply give the victim a number? This is number 28. And we never have to know anything about the victim so that when the jury is making that ultimate determination, that moral judgment, what was the loss to society from this victim? They'll never know who he was or what his contribution to society was. I think that really goes too far. And I think there is a principled reason that the court could say Booth was right because it was outrageous, goes way beyond what we can tolerate, but that some evidence about the victim alone, tempered by the trial judge's admonition to avoid undue prejudice, could be appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Monk. Mr. Burns, you have 5 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Initially, I think the crucial problem with the State's position, as I now understand it to be, is the Court's opinion set forth in the joint appendix at 136 to 141. Curiously, there's not a word about new law, announcing new forms. What the Court says is petitioners got it all wrong. This is what it's always meant. The crucial point for the State to be right is just the opposite, that the Court is changing the law. But the Court specifically rejects that. And when the Court does that, the instruction on 95, of course, cuts against the State's case because you only have yes or no. And the Court very clearly at 139 and 140 says, we always imagine the jury would know that you had this maybe, leave it blank. On the victim impact, I would only say that I don't agree with the State that anyone's in the lowest rung of humanity. And I don't think it's necessary to build up his contribution to society for all of us to take into consideration, as a jury does at the trial, the facts and circumstances of the crime. And I think this Court was right in Booth, and I'm glad to see Mr. Monk today think, in at least most respects, that he was wrong on that day.
So you can't say that we must accept the Maryland Supreme or the Court of Appeals construction of the form that you were just talking about. And yet not accept it for another reason.
Oh, Justice White, I think you can accept. I've never said you shouldn't accept the interpretation of what the jury should do. My only contention is, in this case at this point, is the Court of Appeals' position is untenable that a jury actually, with these instructions in this form, could have done that. Obviously, I don't think that this Court should change the interpretation of the Maryland Court of Appeals as what it should mean. But the question here is, in this case, could a reasonable juror have, from this form and these instructions, gathered all of this material in 136 to 141? That's our position.
Well, if we're free to do that, why, I suppose we're free to accept the State's submission.
I don't think so, Justice White.
Well, I know, but there's nothing to bar us. We're not legally barred.
Of course, the Supreme Court can do anything, Justice
no,
White.
No, it can't. Well, we usually don't disagree with the state courts on their construction of their own law or their own
Certainly
doctrine.
True, Justice White.
But you're asking us to do what?
I'm not asking at all to say their construction is wrong. I'm simply saying, if this is the correct construction of this, we didn't get the benefit of it under these instructions and this sentencing form. That's the reason that it was unfair.
Well, they said you did.
Well, that's the part we disagree with
well,
the Court. But that's not disagreeing with their construction of a law. That's their disagreeing with their interpretation of the instructions and effect of the form in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Monk. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday, the 4th of April at 10 o'clock.